This is Neil Preston, and you are listening to Pantheon Podcasts.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Toronto, Canada. Muses with your hosts, Shanti and Lynx. Part of the Pantheon Network of Podcasts. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. So grab those backstage passes and let's get to the show.
Hey everyone. You know that Led Zeppelin song, Going to California, that goes, "Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair"? Well, today, we talked to that woman. Yep, today's episode is speaking with Michelle Overman. You might also know Michelle from those beautiful Baron Woolman photos in the 1960s. She's got this long, blondy hair and this beautiful vest. Absolutely stunning. So today we talk about Michelle growing up in Greenwich Village, her modeling days, hanging out and dating then unknown musicians such as Steven Tyler, David Gilmour, and Robert Plant, and her amazing friendships with women like Pamela DeBar, Catherine James, and Patti d'Arbenville. Enjoy the show.
Just want to thank you again for doing this with us. We've been really looking forward to this. To begin, I wanted to ask you about growing up in Greenwich Village. I think I read that you were close with your sister and your mother. Greenwich Village is like my favorite place in this entire world. I was just curious what it was like growing up there in New York.
Well, it happened to be probably the best time to be in the village in the early 60s, mid-60s. It was magical. And almost everybody that I know from that period that I'm still in touch with, and that's a lot of people because we all, you know, had this special bond, say that it was the best time of their life. And, I mean, a lot of people say that. And I've had people get in touch with me on Facebook that I haven't seen in like 40 years, and it's like instant, no time passed when she reconnected. And a lot of them are from the village. I went to a really great summer camp in Vermont every summer for 2 months, which is great for New York City kids. This is when the summers in the country. And it was owned by Pete Seeger's brother, the folk singer Pete Seeger, his brother John. So they all the counselors were musicians. That's where I learned to play guitar. And several of those friends from camp came to the village and wound up staying and becoming like part of the village scene. But it was a magical time. We used to see Dylan on the street, and every Sunday there would be folk singers in the park. So I kind of grew up in this world that was nothing like Middle America. Yeah. It really wasn't. And we have a couple of groups on Facebook, Greenwich Village Kids, that a friend of mine started as a website years ago. And we're still in touch, and when I go to New York, we get together. It's amazing that, A, we all look so good, considering that we're, you know, not kids. And B, that we still instantly have that connection. It's like the village just, you know, comes back. And my very first job ever was at the 9L Cafe after school.
Wow.
And I had lunch with Joe Mara the last time I was in New York. And he took me to lunch, and he was so sweet. And he, remembered me so well. And I was, I did work there for about a year and a half. But he said, "You were a teenage goddess." And I had no idea he liked me so much. And even, this guy that was from a completely different walk of life, but he was kind of like the Bill Graham of the village scene, because all those musicians got exposure and a break because of him. I was at the night of the first New York City blackout, and I remember the lights started going dim outside. It had just gotten to be, time to turn the street lights, city street lights on, and they all go out again. I go out in the Waverly Theater, the lights go out. And so what do? We put candles on the tables. He calls back. My brain just went, Richie Havens, who came in and did an acoustic set. And we just had business as usual. And he told me that he paid Richie Havens more money than anybody else that played there. And the reason was because he had a family. So that's the kind of environment the Village was. It was just incredible. We would like all be in the park. One night I remember somebody brought us LSD. We were really young. This was like, well, it was still legal. There was like 15 of us all high on acid. And everybody remembers it. And they remember that night in particular.
Wow.
And I remember the first, yeah, and like when we saw Dylan, everybody would be like running. It was like right in the beginning of his fame when Mr. Tambourine Man came out. And we were kids, of course. We were too young to go to the bar. Not that that really stopped us. but we would like follow him, you know, because he was the, you know, not the Messiah, but he really was kind of like a Pied Piper. And the night out, of course, I met a lot of people that later became well-known. When I drove across country, the one and only time I did that was with John Boylan, who was in a band called the Gingermen, and he later became Linda Ronstadt's first producer. And I was friends with 11 Spoonful, especially Steve Boone. Steve and Zolli, the two that actually, I don't know if you know the story about them getting busted. And oh my gosh, it was awful. They were arrested, and back in those days, people went to jail for years for marijuana. And they got busted, and the cops scared them so badly that they wound up ratting on somebody. And it was a huge, huge stink. They wound up being kicked out of the band, and their careers never recovered. And it was a shame, because they were both really nice guys. I had a friend who... A woman, a girl, she was, you know, 17, young kid. She went to, she's busted for pot, went to a mental hospital. Her penalty was she had to go to a mental hospital for 2 years at that age for smoking pot.
Oh my goodness. So there was,
yeah, it was pretty nuts. But LSD in the beginning was legal. We used to go up to the cops on McDougal Street, like the beat cops, and we still had them then, and take it in front of them, and they couldn't do anything about it. And there was like a group of us, and my friend Chris calls us the good girl gang. We were like, he said, you were functionally feral, but we never really did anything terrible. But a lot of us were latchkey kids, so our parents either worked, or a lot of us had just moms. You know, we were from divorced families, and so mom had to work, and we didn't mind. You know, like me and Patty grew up, Patty Jordan and I grew up together. And then she and it's funny because she and Pamela became best friends, and I always knew that they would get along if they ever met. They had so much in common, and yeah, they did.
Oh, that's
so that
neat.
Yeah. The Village was, and then my second job was working at Paraphernalia, which is a boutique that carried. Actually, the only designer was Betsy Johnson. It was like her boutique, and my job was dancing, modeling the clothes, dancing in the window. And you can do that when you're 15. I mean, now I have no interest. Well, even in my mid-20s, I probably wouldn't have had the salt to do that. But
well, you're a teenage goddess. What else is a teenage goddess to do but model and dance in a window?
Yeah, I was pretty darn cute. But the thing is, I always thought that other girls were prettier. Catherine James showed up, and she was a runaway, and she and I became pals and hung out. And my sister absolutely hated it, because my sister was a couple years older than me, and she was like the queen bee of the Village. And then here comes somebody just a little bit maybe better looking than she was, or as good looking. So I thought Catherine was prettier than me. I thought my girlfriend Jeanette was. So I always kind of, you know, knew I was pretty, but you knew that I wasn't like maybe the most. I was pretty darn good looking. I have to say.
Yeah,
we all were though.
Yeah, you were.
Pamela to me was like the fairy on top of the Christmas tree, not the angel, but the fairy on top of the Christmas tree.
You are all so beautiful, and all of your photos and everything, they, even to this day, people, they're showing up on all different kinds of sites and blogs and Instagrams, because people are obsessed with that time and those photos and that beauty. How old were you when you began modeling, and what led to that?
I was 14 or 15. I think the earliest ones I have, I was 14. But mostly 15, and then 16, and then some of the pictures that you see of me, like wearing a like a leather, actually suede, beaded kind of Indian hippie vest. That was actually a prop that belonged to the photographer. Those pictures just seem to have really shaken mood as something that, you know, people like. And that's right around the time I met Robert. I was 18. In fact, the first night that they played in New York City at the Fillmore East, it was the day after my 18th birthday. That's when I met him.
And the Robert that you were referring to is, of course, Robert Plant?
Yes. Yeah.
Just for those listeners who might be going, is that the Robert we think she's talking about? Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's the same one. And when I met him, they weren't famous. Jimmy was because of the Yardbirds, but the other guys weren't. Nobody knew who he was. When he announced the band at the Fillmore East, I thought he said Robert Plant. I didn't even hear his name correctly because I didn't know who. Nobody did. But every groupie in New York, I worked at the Scene Club, of course. I was like just always at the right place at the right time. I was very lucky that way. And the Scene, every band that came to New York, like from England, they always went down there because that's where you went. And so I met a lot of people when they first came, when they weren't famous. I went out with David Gilmour. In fact, that's a kind of a long story. I don't know if you've ever seen the picture of the Pink Floyd football club. It was 1973. There's the band and their roadies, and then there's a row of women in the front. There's Ginger, and next to Ginger is me, and then on the other side of me is Pretty Watts, who was Peter Watts' wife at the time.
No, we haven't seen that. I want to look it up immediately.
Well, I can send you a lot of these things.
Oh, and I love that.
And Robert actually asked me, so did Steven Tyler. They both asked me if I had pictures of us in those days, but we didn't take pictures back then like you guys do. And it's really a shame.
Isn't there a photo with your hand on Robert's shoulder or something?
His head? On his head. I remember, yeah, he said he wanted part of me in the picture, so I picked my hand up and put it on his head. And actually, a photograph of us together from that night showed up, and I have it. You probably know which picture it is. I'm actually rolling a joint. He used to make me carry the pot because he said if he gets busted, he can't come back to America and he'd have to get a job. Didn't want to do that. I want you to be able to, you know, stay in. And he was, I think I had him at his best. He said in an interview that the first 2 years of Going to California, that song was written about the first 2 years of his being in Led Zeppelin. And those were the years we were together, from the first album to the fourth. I was there when they recorded a lot of the fourth album. I was at Headley Grange with him. That's when I first went to England. And I didn't follow him there, as Pamela said in her book. I did not follow him. We planned it together. I went straight from the airport to their roadies, Platt, Clive, Coulson, and from there I went to Headley Grange. And he didn't have two kids, and he only had his daughter. He told me that, I mean, one thing about Robert, he can be so loving and so affectionate and effusive, and then when you're gone, he'll, like, forget about you because he's so busy and has so many things in his life and so many people. And Robert had asked me the last time I saw him, which was 2 years earlier, if there were any pictures of us together. And I said, I don't think so because we never took any. And he was real afraid of it in those days because, you know, he had just, you know, started becoming famous. He didn't know how Maureen was going to take it. If she found out he'd fallen in love with somebody a couple months after they were married. Because I met him right after he was married. Yeah. And his daughter was only a month old. You can fill in the blanks. So he comes up to me and he says, he stands real close to me and he says, my friend Penny's there, and he says, I understand I've been bested by the front man, Aerosmith. Mm-hmm. He must have read somewhere or heard somewhere that I claimed that Stephen was a better lover than he was. And what do you say to somebody like Robert Plant when they say, because in that moment, he told me I was the ideal. They treated me so well. They were wonderful. I know Jimmy wanted us to stay together because he said it was good for Robert. Because I was, you know, kind of like the antidote. I was like their conscience. They could forget about all the crap they'd done because then they treated me so well, which I think is kind of shitty. But so I didn't know what to say. And, you know, there's so much crap that's misunderstood or misquoted. And of course I never said that. The question I was asked, who was a better boyfriend? And I said, Stephen, because he wasn't married. And like I got to be with him all the time. I was never in love with Stephen. I mean, he was a wonderful guy, great fun. And he slept with my poetry book under his pillow for two years. Uh-oh. And I'll always love him, but I was never in love with him like I was with Robert. So I was never in love with anybody like I was in love with him.
I would love to hear about that vest that you made him.
Oh yeah, that's a big deal because he loved that vest and wore it all. He really loved it. It was a labor of love. I was 18 and a half. We had just really started our relationship got serious from the beginning. It was in New York we met, and every groupie in New York was after him. And I just said, I'm not going to fight these girls, you know. But he pursued me, and then at the Phil Maurice, before the show, we were sitting in the restaurant next door, and he comes up, he said, well, hi, there you are. And he literally said, would you like to come and see my etching? And he remembered saying that. So I just knew then we were going to be together. And so after I saw the show, I couldn't believe it. They opened for the Iron Butterfly, who didn't want to go on stage after them. So that night, day after my 18th birthday, it was the first night we were together. And I didn't know he was married. I didn't know he had a kid. And I saw a picture of a small photo of a baby, a real young baby. And my heart just sank. I just knew it was his kid and that she was young and he must be married and blah, blah, blah. Well, he didn't say anything about it. But obviously, it finally came out. We spent a little bit of time together. But he said, why didn't you let me catch you when my first body? We could have spent all this time together. So I didn't, I didn't see him for a couple of months, and I had moved to LA in the meantime. So, and then I met Pamela at the Palomino, and after he left, I had a little fling with Graham, who I had a crush on, but I knew, always knew, that Robert was going to be the love of my life. So I had this crush on Graham, and I met her at the Palomino. She was, there seeing Chris, and I was there seeing Graham, and we met on the dance floor. And we did have a huge girl crush on each other. We ended up living together, sleeping in the same bed for months. No, we weren't lovers, almost, but no, we didn't actually do it. And then I saw Robert and passed a message to her from Jimmy, and then the four of us were like, it was a lot of fun. But she really downplayed my part in that, in her life, because she wanted her relationship with Jimmy to stand out, which is okay, but she kind of was a little bit disingenuous. She never mentioned that we lived together in the first book. She was living with a girl named Michelle, and a lot of the things she says and says, Michelle this, it was me. And the funny thing is that people that know me knew right away that it was me that she was talking about, even though she doesn't say so. And she also said that I went to England, I followed Robert to England when she first went there, which is not true. I was still in L.A. with Robert, and then I went to New York where she met me. She didn't go to Cincinnati. When she came back from England, we met in New York. I was working there, saving money, staying with my mom. And I know this for a fact because she was on her way back to L.A. and I had just come from there. So we kind of passed, going in different directions. And I remember I got a great job at a club, the Hippopotamus Club, which was run by Bradley Pierce, who was the manager of Ondine's, which is where the Doors first played when they first came to New York, and where I met Jimi Hendrix, who fell in love with my best friend, Jeanette, who was the other girl that I thought was my first best friend, Lisa. I thought she had the edge on me, and then Catherine and Jeanette Jacobs. She was in a band called The Cake. It was a girl group, three of them. And wrote their own songs. They were way ahead of the curve. And Jimmy saw her and used to sit by the seat. He wasn't in his own band then. He was a backup player for a guy named Curtis Knight and the Squires. I was 15. Jimmy was not famous at all. So he sits on the side of the stage at this little table, and he calls me over and says, if you could put a good word in with your girlfriend, I'd be eternally grateful. So I told Jeanette, this guy likes you. And I kind of found out later, she didn't advertise it, but she was biracial. Her dad was black, and her mom was Greek. But then I wound up living with her and her dad for quite a while, on and off, and he's black. But she kind of said he was her stepdad for, I don't know what was going on. But she was the love of his life. I don't care what anybody says. And I had some of his clothes because whenever he was in town, we'd go to the hotel and she'd just go through his closet, take whatever she wanted. And, you know, he always... So Jimi Hendrix and I met before he was famous. I met David Gilmour. Every single guy I knew or went out with before they were famous. And I never chased anybody. You know, I had relationships with people because of the life I lived. And I mean, maybe at the scene you could say it was a bit of a group because it was like being a little kid in a candy store. You know, all these guys came. They were all British. They all were charming. They were all musicians. And, you know, you got to meet them. And I worked there, so...
Mm-hmm. How was it that you met Steven Tyler? How did that come about? That was before he was famous too, right?
Yes. Yeah, he wasn't... There was no Aerosmith. He was in a band called Chain Reaction. Well, we went to the same high school, but it wasn't like high school, like regular high school. It was a private professional soldiering school, so you only had to go 4 hours a day just for the academics. And most of the kids were like actors. A lot of models went there. I know Chris Stein went there, and a bunch of other people you might have, you know, that you would know. Yeah. Nancy Allen, who was in she was in a bunch.
Blowout.
She was my best friend.
Really, in school. I love her. Brian De Palma.
Yeah,
right?
I've got some great pictures of the two of us where we're both topless. but she went there. Stephen had graduated the year before. And he was always down the village. I probably met him in the village. So he used to pick me up from high school in his friend Henry's mom's car. And they lived in Yonkers, which is just outside of outside of New York City, beyond the city limits is the Bronx. And then there's the township of Yonkers, which is suburban. It's like a bedroom community. And his parents were never there, so we had the house to ourselves. And that's another thing. Pamela said in the book that I had to step over, like, people jostling all over the living room floor to go to school. That's not true. I never said anything like that. And I don't want Stephen to think I said that, because I didn't. I never would have disgraced him like that, saying that there was, like, you know, people just crashing all over his floor. That's not true. We had people hanging out, because, you know, let's face it, you're 18, your girlfriend's 17, and you know, it's the 60s and you know all these people. Yeah, we partied there. So that wasn't true. And I want to see him. My friend Penny, the one who actually, she was my witness when Robert Plant sang Going to California to me backstage, holding my hands, looking in my eyes. She saw the whole thing. So, and he also sang it to me from the stage once, and we're sitting in the front row, because, you know, we were his guests, and it was a pretty small venue. So when you're in the front row, if he stands at the end of the proscenium, the stage, he can see you, and you can see him. He sang it to me from the stage, and my friend David said, "He's singing, he's looking at you." And afterwards, he said, backstage, he said, "Did you see me looking at you singing?" I said, "How could you not sing?"
So cute.
So I have pretty strong proof that, you know, the whole song was not written for me, and I know because Jimmy told me, but I wasn't one of the inspirations, and that the girl with the flowers in her hair is me.
I love how the girl from New York ended up being the girl in the song for Going to California. I never put those two things together, but you did seem very, your vibe seemed very California in many of the photos. Long blonde hair.
Yep. Very California girl. In fact, I always said that when I really felt at home the first time I went to L.A. I know you're not supposed to say that because, you know, like, especially people from San Francisco really poo-poos L.A., you know. But I loved it. And my husband actually pinned it down real well. There's something about the light there that's magical, which is why the film industry was there. And I'm very sensitive. I'm one of those people that they call overly sensitive people. Like, my environment really affects me. Which is bad, but it's also good because I feel more that's good, but I also am affected by bad things like sound and smell. But the good thing is when I went there, the light was just seemed so magical, you know, and I just always had great karma out there. So when I went out there, and I was staying in this, I went right from New York, from Manhattan to living in Laurel Canyon, this house in the middle of nowhere with birds singing in the morning and you're 10 minutes from the Strip. It was just great. And I knew Robert and I would be together, and I knew that we were going to have a serious relationship. sometimes you just know stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's so much. And another thing that Pamela did in the book that really bothered me is she kept trying to make it seem like I had no idea about Shirley, Robert's sister-in-law, and that it came as a great show. He told me about it when we were first together. I knew all about it. Mm-hmm. He never hid any of that stuff from me. And she also said that my first boyfriend was Ralph Scala from the Blues Magoos. They were the house band at the Night Owl, and I was really young. I was 14. He was 18. I was so in love with this guy, and he thought I was too young. And it wasn't about, being jailbait, because people didn't think like that in those days. I mean, this term jailbait was known, but he just thought I was too young. And then I was so in love with him for months, and he finally said, I'm going to have to let you know when everybody else knows that I'm in love with you. So we had a really good relationship for a year and a half. And they lived when they were the house band, they lived at the Hotel Albert, which was a residential hotel. It was actually famous. Like, a lot of people stayed there. And a lot of the band stayed there. They all did. And she said that I used to come home from high school and get fucked and then go back to school at lunch. I never talked like that in my life. I never, ever, ever was cool like that. I was too shy, for one thing. I was very, very shy, which now people don't believe, but you get to hide it well. And the thing is, Quintanos, you didn't go back to school. Once it was like noon, you were done, because it was supposed to be the half the day you worked. So I don't know why she put that in, but I never said it.
Well, I think that there's going to be a really nice opportunity for you to tell your own story when you're ready, in your own book and in your own words. And so I think that you've lived one of the most fantastic, growing up in New York and going to California. And like you said, just being in the right place at the right time, being a goddess, being pursued by the most gorgeous and talented men of rock and roll history. Girl, you got to write a book.
I'm going to. And, let me tell you one story, though. This is an anecdote I love. When Robert played at the Arlington Concert Hall the second time, the first time was me and my boyfriend at the time, because I'm my husband, and two friends of mine. It was a little different. That was the time when we took all these great pictures that I have, and he's like candid ones, and he's just like really affectionate. And I've got pictures that I won't let on the internet because I'm saving them for my book. One my husband took, and Robert's got this like mischievous grin on his face, and he's hugging me, and he never smiles in pictures backstage, but in these he is. But in this first, and the second time, I brought some friends with me, and I looked really good that day. I know I did. And I was in the restroom, this woman came up and she said, "Are you Michelle Overman?" Because a documentary had come out. And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I knew you were going to be here, but I didn't think I'd get to see you." She took this young woman, took me by the hands, looked me in the eye, and she said, "I just want you to know, if meeting you is a bigger thrill than it would be meeting Robert Plant." I couldn't believe it. I was so touched. Because women can identify with my story. They can actually, and because I'm pretty, I'm accessible, I'm not a snob. I don't believe any of that bullshit. I mean, if somebody's a jerk, I won't pay them any attention, but I'm not a snob. I don't understand why people are like that except they're insecure. And I like people. So I was very touched. And then she said, "Do you mind if my boyfriend takes a photograph of us together?" I said, "No, of course not." She was so sweet. And when she said that, she looked me in the eye and she said, "I just want you to know." And she said, "Meeting you is a bigger thrill than it would be meeting him." Because women can identify with me. They can put themselves in my shoes and imagine what it would be like. It's impossible. How can you imagine being Robert Plant? I can't even do that, because his life is so different from, just about any kind of anything in your life that you can identify with.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to be Robert Plant, but I wouldn't mind being with him. And you're one of those women that was pursued by him. And I think a lot of people have been asking, when are you going to get Michelle on? Are you able to talk to Michelle? Can you interview her? Because that's it. Like, you and Pamela and Catherine James, you're all famous in your own right. People value you for who you are and your experience dances, and you're as much a part of rock and roll history as any of those guys too, because if it weren't for you, there'd be no them.
And you know what? They all joined bands to meet girls. That's the reason most of them picked up a guitar in the first place, and they'll admit it. You know, it's true. And I am a singer, and I, you know, used to, in fact, Stephen tried to, he talked about us starting a band together. Too bad that didn't pan out, huh?
That would
have been
amazing.
He's a freaking genius, though. Yeah, it would have. It would have been good. And if I'd been in the right place at the right time, I would have pursued it. So I just had to admire Joni Mitchell and want to be her from afar. I met her. I socialized with her. I've got so many damn stories. I look at my own life. I can't believe it happened. You know, I'm very grateful. Let's put it that way. And I do want to write my story because I owe it to my mom, because I always was good at English and creative writing. And I know that nothing in the world would make her happier than for me to write a book. Mm. And the second reason is everybody has a story in them. Everybody on earth has a story. And most of them, people would be surprised how interesting other people's lives are. But mine is the kind of story people want to hear. And I feel I have this almost duty to write it, because she gets credit for it. Maya Angelou didn't say it originally. Who was it that said it? There's no greater agony than having an untold story inside you, or an unborn story inside you.
Yes, exactly.
And it's true. And I love you guys so much. And one of the biggest surprises in my life is how many young women get it, you know, and that understand what it was like and love us for it. It's just, you know, it gives me a lot of faith in the world to see people like you.
Oh, thank you. And we love being
I'm getting
part
all teary-eyed thinking about it. No, seriously, it's been really gratifying for me, you know, and I've had the best experience on social media. Mine is probably unusual, but I'm looking right now at a painting that a young woman did of me, an oil painting she did of me at the period I was with Robert. And it's a beautiful painting. I never met this girl. She sent me this painting. Of course, I gave her the picture. And other people have sent me gifts. And it's because something that I have makes people happy, I got to write my book.
You have a beauty inside of you, too, because the outer only gets any of us so far.
Yeah.
But you have that sustainable, like, inside beauty. We can tell, like, you love animals. You're a kind person.
Oh, God.
And we all identify with that, and we love being a part of this supportive community of women who build each other up and who want to see each other succeed and just continue to spread love and joy in this world, because as light workers, we need to do that. There's too much darkness around. It's up to us to continue to spread love and joy.
Yep. And it's not just about you feeling love, but it's contagious. And I remember, you know, my spiritual leader said, try to love those who you cannot love, because the more you think of others with love and kindness, the more you forget yourself. And when you forget yourself completely, you find God. And it's true. It's like you can't lose. The people that are most admired and that other people want to be like are kind people, because they're the happiest. It's true. And then, of course, there's people like Dylan. I was probably a real shit to other people. And I met the Beatles, too, when I was really young, when I was 14.
Did.
That's another story. Yep.
Are you saving that
when
one?
I was.
Are you saving that one for your book?
Well, kind of. I met them when I was. It's kind of a complicated story. The person I liked the best, though, in those days, which was 1966, was John.
Oh, interesting.
By far. I thought he was, yeah. He was, to me, personally, he was the nicest. And the one who was kind of the freshest, kind of like nudge-nudge, was George.
Yeah, of course he was. Of course he was.
Yes, yes. And Ringo was just cranky because he didn't want all these people around. And it must have been really hard for them. You know, even with all the good they got, it must have been just really hard to deal with everything like being on all the time. And Paul just, who I'd had a total crush on, you know, when I was young, seemed a little just too kind of corny. And I've met him since, because I lived with Denny and JoJo Lane, he was in Wings. And so I socialized with Paul. I was at his house St. John's Wood. And one story I will share with you is when I was there with Denny. And Linda made pea soup, which we all, you know, had. And I thought my pea soup is just as good as hers. She used salt pork. I didn't. Mine was vegetarian. But anyway, she made this great soup. And Martha, the dog, you know, the sheepdog, was running up and down. This a beautiful house, of course. Martha. And their daughter Stella was about 7 at the time. And we had Denny's little boy with us, Lane. He was about 3 at the time. And Stella McCartney comes up to me and says, "Would you hug me, hold me and hug me like you hugged that little boy?" And I'd never seen this child before in my life. Aww. It was just and I don't know why she said it. I knew Linda in New York. Linda, you know, she's nice. I always got along very well with her. She's always very nice to me. I have not a bad word to say about Linda McCartney. You know, so I'm convinced she was a lovely woman. And was great for Paul. Yeah. But either she was open enough to ask for love from someone who she saw giving it, which I think is really freaking cool. You know, it couldn't have been that she wasn't getting it from her folks, because first of all, why would she come up to somebody she never saw and say something like that, you know? But I've never forgotten it.
Wow, well, you were just a beautiful being that was radiating light and love, and she picked up on it, and she wanted some of that.
And another story I'll tell you, and if you need to go, we can go, but I do want to tell you the story.
Yeah, let's hear one more story, and then we'll wrap it up.
A lot of poetry when I was younger, a lot, all the time. I always had a notebook with me, and I kept them. Pamela was always a writer, this is something else. Pamela was always a writer. When I met her, she kept a journal, and she inspired me to keep a journal. And, I emulated her a lot. I was like her first student. She always had these stories, and she always wrote them down. Everything she had in the first book, she had in her journal. She didn't have to write much. She had already written it. She was always a great storyteller. Always, always, always. And so she got me, you know, into writing. And I wrote all the time. I wrote poetry, and then I started keeping a journal. Well, when I moved out here from New York, I went to my aunt's house because she had all the stuff in her basement I was keeping. And my poetry books, 2 of them, disappeared. It was the worst loss I've ever experienced. Actually, I've never found them. There was one book that survived that was in, you know, the trunk, and that was the poems I wrote when Robert and I were together.
Wow.
Those I managed to somehow stay with me. The rest, I don't know where they are. So I remember my sister saying how she loved my poetry. This was years ago, and I said, "Yeah, well, I was inspired by somebody who was, you know, really beautiful." And she said, "No," she said, "all that beauty came out of you."
It did, exactly.
And
wow.
I never forgot it. And everybody has, if they have that light in it, you really have to let it shine.
Yeah, we can't wait for you to write this book.
Well, I could sit here all day and talk, but I got to say some of it. No, I'm just kidding. There's a lot, a lot. And most all of it has been really good. And even the bad stuff isn't really bad in retrospect. Because it all made me strong, you know. I'm a lot tougher than I look. You know, I've learned that with my spinal surgery.
Yeah.
You know, I would do it again if I had to. And it was brutal. It was brutal, but it was totally worth it.
Yeah, you are strong and amazing. And actually, I think you and Link kind
How
of look like
you
a little
might
bit
ask?
With that blonde hair and the bangs.
You did. I noticed that you girls are adorable. No, you live in Canada.
Yeah, we're in Toronto.
So how far is that from the Pacific Northwest? What part of Canada is that? Just further east, or is it?
It's
I should know.
It's about like a 9-hour drive from New York, from Manhattan.
The only place in Canada I've ever been was in Quebec City. I went there with my summer camp.
Yeah.
My cabin went up there, you know, last year, and it was just freaking beautiful. It's very European.
Mm-hmm. Quebec is where.
That's French. Canada, French
yeah.
Canadian, and then I know Ontario is the capital, and I know that Vancouver is over here. Vancouver,
yeah,
British
we're
Columbia.
We're in Ontario.
That's further east. That's more. It's closer to New York than to here.
Yeah, we're pretty close to New York,
but we're pretty set on doing some traveling, and we've only just started exploring the U.S. Like Lynx goes to New York quite a bit, and last year we went to Tennessee, and I've been to Las Vegas, and neither of us have been out to L.A., but we really eventually want
to
take this on the road, and our mission is to meet every single one of you who we've chatted with, give you a hug, and feel all of that light in person, so we hope to meet you someday in person.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Now, what made you decide to start the? It's a podcast.
Yeah,
Okay. Well, so what made you? What inspired you to do this? I think it's so great that you are, because it really, you know, makes us feel like, you know, you really care, that we're cared about still, and that makes us feel like maybe we've done something right.
Yeah. Well, when we grew up, you know, listening to music, and then we would see photos of these rock stars, we were like, well, that's all good and well, but we always wanted to know, who's the woman? Who are these girls? And what is their story? And just like, you know, the many of those fan blogs online, we were kind of enraptured by your beauty and the essence that you were giving off. And we just knew that there was a story there. And then we discovered Pamela's books. And then through her books, we found out about all of the other women out there who are part of the scene. And, you know, we're living vicariously through your experience, because it's, you know, the music industry and rock and roll and meeting bands, while it's still possible, and we've had our own, you know, stuff here and there, it'll never be like what all of you guys experienced. So we just wanted to hear your story and get to know you and celebrate you and honor you, because we love being a part of, you know, the rock and roll muse groupie sisterhood. And we're
the fact that you
keep going.
Go ahead. The fact that you guys can do this is really fabulous. I mean, you have advantages we didn't have, and I think it's great. I think, you know, it's still tough in a lot of ways to be a woman. And I was lucky growing up in the village I went to. I was in a class for gifted kids, you know, intellectually gifted children. The girls were not treated any different than the guys, believe me. It was also in the village. But still, I mean, there were certain... I remember when I heard that girls couldn't join Little League baseball, I was absolutely outraged. I want to play baseball. How come I can't, just because I'm a girl? You know, and those barriers have broken down. And I think that women like you that are, like, really doing something, you know, and especially that you get it, you know, that what we had was so, it was the music. It really was. Maybe one of these days I'll put my one song on YouTube that people seem to really like. I wrote it for Robert, of course, after we broke up. And it took me 30 years to write the chorus. I wrote the first verse when we broke up. And then, like, decades later, I finished it. The same song.
Well, we would love to hear it. Well, we're so grateful that we got to connect with you. We'll wrap it up and we'll say thank you so much. This really means so much to us, and we love you.
Thank you for you know, giving me this opportunity to speak up.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh,
Michelle.
Thank you. You're welcome. Soon. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, bye for now.
Bye-bye for now.
Muses and Stuff is produced by Chantel Lemieux and Link Solar. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hey there, this is Tyrell Lisson, the host of the band History, a new show that takes a deep dive into the legendary roots rock group The Band. Perhaps one of the most overlooked groups in music history, went from being a backing band to the legends like Ronnie Hawkins and Bob Dylan to creating some of the most influential music of the 1960s and 70s. The band is responsible for the back-to-basics approach to rock in the late 60s, foregoing psychedelia and acid pop of the day, and influencing artists like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Eric Clapton to bring it back to the roots. This new podcast is here to peel back the curtain on the mysterious group that took the music world by storm. Not with press, fancy magazine covers, or massive tours, but with their music. Come and check it out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.